counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. Richard Letchick on behalf of the appellant, Chad Clark. I'll reserve 2 minutes.
Proceed.
The two issues I'd like to focus on this morning concern the sufficiency of the evidence and the issues concerning the jury instructions. I've also raised an issue as to the law of the case doctrine and argued that Mr. Clark's convictions should be reversed and dismissed pursuant to that doctrine, but because Mr. Clark is also entitled to relief under a straight sufficiency of the evidence analysis, I'm going to address that first, and I also recognize I have two judges from the Tyler opinion on the panel.
It's good to recognize things.
Yes. So in terms of the bail jumping conviction, that conviction required the state to prove that Mr. Clark had been released by court order or admitted to bail with knowledge of a subsequent personal appearance before the court. In this case, the state did not submit any evidence that Mr. Clark had in fact been released by a court order or that he had been admitted to bail.
Is there a third option?
Well, there are more unlikely possibilities. He could have been mistakenly released from jail, for example. The Department of Corrections had a scandal a few years back about releasing inmates.
No, but we're talking about evidence.
We're talking about evidence, yeah.
You've just summed up what your argument is. So if there's no evidence, what else is there to say?
Well, the state maintains that you can infer that Mr. Clark had, in fact, been released, and my argument is there's not sufficient evidence to infer that he had it.
Well, why not?
By court order. Why not? That the state has to submit evidence. I mean, all they submitted was that he had a court date that he didn't show up to and that there was a court order letting him know that there was another court date. But that court order had not shown that he had been released by a court order. And it's not difficult for the state to meet this burden. In fact, we know that Mr. Clark had, in fact, been released by court order. We have it in the record. The state simply did not submit it into the evidence.
So this is just a rookie mistake?
That's correct, Your Honor. Turning to the convictions for failure to register, the state was required to prove on those counts that Mr. Clark lacked a fixed residence on all the charge violations. Now, as this court held in the Batson case, 2016 case, that requires the state to prove a negative. It requires the state to prove that Mr. Clark lacked basically an abode that was lawful, that he used the majority of the week. In this case, the state's evidence consisted of him registering as transient about a week before his not showing up, and that was the basis for the state contending that it met its burden. But in Batson, this court held that homelessness is not equivalent to lacking a fixed residence. So the state has to submit evidence to meet its burden, and again, it's a negative, so it's not something that's necessarily easily met. So given the lack of evidence submitted to show that Mr. Clark, in fact, did not have a fixed residence on those four dates, all those convictions should be reversed and dismissed. If Your Honors disagree with me on what I've said for the last few minutes, then we get to the jury instructions, the issues concerning the jury instructions. And those issues, the first one concerns the state omitted a knowledge element in the two convict instructions for failure to register. And the state has conceded error on that point, and that requires the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this error was harmless, and that's done through uncontroverted evidence. Sometimes can meet that burden. The state's conceded can't meet that burden as it counts 1 and 2. As it counts 3 and 4, the state contends that uncontroverted evidence did show that Mr. Clark had knowingly failed to register because they represent that his testimony showed that he purposefully had been not registering, is the state's argument. That's not actually entirely correct. Mr. Clark had testified that it wasn't his intent not to register. And even if you accept the state's argument, there's evidence that Mr. Clark had mental issues. He had issues keeping track of dates. He lacked the means of keeping track of dates. He testified he was under distress. I mean, these are all things that the jury could have taken into account into whether Mr. Clark had knowingly violated his duty to register. So the state cannot meet its burden as to counts 3 and 4 as to that error. And as
we disagree with you on that issue with respect to counts 3 or 4, would we affirm on 2 counts or 1?
This is the unit of prosecution.
Oh, so the double jeopardy issue. So I have
kind of waiting for the meat here.
Okay. Well, if Your Honor agrees with all my other issues, you don't need to reach the double jeopardy issue. But the unit of prosecution, my contention is that there was one unit of prosecution. That unit of prosecution was Mr. Clark's first, I guess, failure to show up, and it's supposed to be a period. It's a little odd because the state didn't charge it as a period. They charged it as on or about this date, that date, this other date, another date.
Regardless, isn't there we issued a decision that talked about the unit of prosecution.
Yes, and in that court, that decision holds that basically it's an ongoing offense, so it's not, each weekly violation is not a separate unit of prosecution, but there's a factual analysis, and the facts don't indicate that different units of prosecution would be justified in this case. The state's contention is that filing a charging document, charging failure to register, creates additional units of prosecution, but that would really undercut this court's opinion direct, and in that case, it would have been completely different had the state simply filed a charging document immediately and then filed another one. So I don't think that's a...
Well, they're trying to distinguish direct.
Yes, and this case is different than direct in that Mr. Clark was arrested and released and picked up another violation, and then he was released again, and then he had more violations, but he actually wasn't arrested. He continued to come to court, and then they gave him additional charges, and then he was arrested at the very end again. If there is only one unit of prosecution, just there's only, if there's insufficient evidence to support that unit of prosecution, I mean, I think everything has to go, and I guess that's the court's opinion in Green.
Why wouldn't there still be one unit of prosecution left, at least for the period before the last arrest?
Yeah. I guess I direct Your Honor to the...
Which would be counts 3 and 4.
In the subsequent Court of Appeals opinion following direct, I think it's called Green, they basically held that wasn't appropriate. There's an acquittal on one date range, and then they tried to come back at him with another date range, and the court said that violates double jeopardy. So I think they get one bite at the apple, so to speak.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Eric Peterson from the Skagit County Prosecutor's Office representing the state of Washington. So I look at this double jeopardy argument and look at it and when you're dealing with a continuing offense, which is different than a lot of other offenses, say a theft charge, that happens when you have an ongoing scheme where someone's committing the theft. Maybe law enforcement finds out about it and arrests the charges, but the theft is ongoing. Well, in that circumstance, and continues on while the case is going, and law enforcement finds out and later finds out more charges, more facts, and more theft has occurred. Is it a continuing offense? Well, it's a conduct which is continuing. Does that mean there's different counts of theft based on the start frame of this theft and when it ended? Was it charged? Where does that apply? So I looked at it at the spectrum. Let's start at both ends of the spectrum. Done your time, convicted, done your time, sentenced, and done in prison time. So that's at one extreme. Clearly you can charge another count of failure to register because we have repeat violations. At the other end, you're out of custody, never been charged, and you're not registering. So you do that, and I think the cases of Durrett and Green that we're talking about are situations where a person was never brought to court to charge. Not arrested, not charged, not arrested, not arraigned, no court dates were set, no trial occurred, no verdict, no sentencing.
What's your view of what happens Let's say that a person doesn't register, and every Monday the prosecutor trots down to the courthouse, files an information, and then sends the information and summons to the last address the alleged defendant has provided. Can the prosecutor do that and say charge, and the police have trouble finding this guy for 52 weeks, charge 52 counts because they filed charges every Monday?
Can a prosecutor do that? Yes, of course you can do that.
How many crimes I've committed depends not at all on either what the defendant knows or what the defendant has done differently. Because we would agree that the prosecutor could charge one count for that continuous period on the 52nd week.
Correct.
So does it seem anomalous to you that the prosecutor's actions alone would determine whether a defendant is liable for 52 counts of a felony or one?
I'm not asking that this court make a rule on double jeopardy with respect to the prosecutor's acts of charging. I believe that the line should be drawn and at one of two locations. One is arrest, the other one is arraignment. Because at arraignment, a person is aware of the charge that they have pending against them and their conduct has stopped. The court has taken authority to deal with the case and set conditions on the person. Then the person gets released.
How do you reconcile that with a presumption of innocence?
Pardon?
How do you reconcile the court has taken action or something has happened with the presumption of innocence?
I guess
that person is not presumed to have committed any crime just because they were arrested or just because they were hailed into court and arraigned. We still presume they've committed no crime.
Right, but the court has put the person on notice that the charge with respect to this conduct has commenced, and the court has taken authority to deal with the person.
Well, doesn't there have to be some merit to the allegation before there's notice?
I don't believe the court has to weigh or the court should consider the strength of the allegation when determining whether or not the person
is on notice.
What if it turns
out the person was not guilty of a crime for which they were arraigned?
Well, and that could have occurred as to counts 1, 2, or 3 here, and the defendant could have been convicted on count 4.
But the clock's
and that doesn't mean that the defendant should be acquitted as to count 4 because the jury returned not guilty verdicts as to counts 1, 2, and 3. And there's a number of structures that our courts use. I mean, same criminal conduct is a sentencing analysis that can be applied to this circumstance. And I know it's different than double jeopardy. Believe me, I've been down in the Supreme Court and had Justice Madsen get on me about my interpretation of double jeopardy with respect to same continuing course of conduct. But in this situation where you have two extremes, and Durant and Green fall clearly on the side of before charging, and in fact, Durant said mentioned arrest.
Argument wanted either arraignment or arrest.
Well,
I thought you just said you argue for two places to draw the line: arrest or arraignment. Charging wouldn't be one of those.
No, I think that's the appropriate point to draw the line. Now, Your Honor might say, well, earlier arrest, but I think that I'm trying to address the court's concern with respect to the prosecutor's action causing different offenses, and that can be considered distinct for double jeopardy. And I think that's what we have here, a situation where a person comes to court, is informed that they've been charged to fail to register, aware of their ongoing obligation, and then continue to not register again. It's not, you're basically talking about prospectively charging one for someone's future,
right. But
future failures to appear.
The distinction in this circumstance is the Durrett opinion turned on the conduct being continuing until there was a conviction for the crime. It didn't turn and make a distinction based on arrest or prosecution or arraignment, and neither did Green. There was a single arrest and a single conviction. And here, all of the acts occurred before there was a conviction. And he was released, rearrested, and so the same principles that were articulated in Durrett would still seem to apply. And the legislature hasn't seen fit to reject the Durrett analysis.
Well, because the Durrett analysis mentions wasn't dealing with the issue that we have here, where a person was charged, appeared before court, arraigned, and then released. So Durrett wasn't providing a distinction based on...
What did Durrett say started the clock again?
It didn't specifically say.
That's right.
It suggested that arrest started that clock again. And think about that. That put the defendant on notice as to his conduct of not registering.
But there was never an issue about whether he knew he was supposed to register.
Apart from the charging language or the,
no, I mean,
the jury instruction on that part. But
he wasn't disputing that he knew he needed to register. So
right.
Being reminded by being arrested or prosecuted wasn't the issue. The issue was simply what is the unit of prosecution and does conviction restart the clock? Because he hadn't re-registered. And it wasn't, has he been given notice it restarts? So it seems it's wide open, and the question is what's...
When you charge there. A defendant based on his actions on a particular day, because he wasn't registering and he was transient, which would require to come in and register, and you charge that conduct, that's one act that he has done. The question the court is struggling with, and I'm trying to provide some my position on, is whether or not then subsequent acts that occur after that point, after a person has come to court, still constitute the same crime for which he had already been charged, appeared in court, and arraigned on.
Let me embrace the arrest issue then and say, as to count one, I didn't see anything in the record that established that the state proved he was living in Skagit County during the period for which he was charged with arrest, and his evidence was he was out of state. So assume count one goes away and you're left with 2, 3, and 4. You've got the knowing issue going on, and you've got arrest. Don't you have one arrest that affects the other three counts?
Are you talking the arrest that counts after count one was charged because he got picked up and then?
If you start from the last arrest, what do you have left in front of you? You've got counts 3 and 4, and is there harmless error on the knowing because of the jury instruction? And you've got count 2 and a question there on whether that one's out because of the jury instruction.
Right. And I'm acknowledging that we didn't put the knowing element in those instructions.
Right.
So we're not talking about that. I think.
So what do you think under the arrest theory? Have you got 3 left, 2 left, or 1 left?
I'm saying he has 2 left. Of course, you have to reverse counts 1 and 2 to remand for retrial in those particulars. Counts for proper jury instruction. But I think my position on double jeopardy is laid out. I want to touch on bail jumping real quick because the court needs to go back and look at the defendant's testimony on that particular fact, because the defendant himself acknowledged that he had been released from court and didn't appear. When he came back from Alaska, he didn't register, and this is on page 171 of the transcripts. Okay, and then you got out of jail, right? Yes. And the defendant is shown Exhibit 15, where he signs a date of 2/21/4 after he got released from the jail. And if you read on the transcript from there, it shows that the defendant admitted that he was released by the court to appear. So there's sufficient evidence from that to draw for a jury to conclude that he was guilty.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I'm working backward. The Alaska evidence concerned the first conviction. The bail jump concerned the last conviction. So I'm not sure.
Was the record clear about that?
I think the record is clear that there's...
That his testimony only related to the first charge?
I'm not sure exactly what testimony counsel is talking about, but...
We'll all look at the testimony?
Yeah.
Well, he just gave the date. Wasn't it February 21st? Is that what you said?
Well, the last count concerned November 3rd, so he was basically released September 25th, is my recollection, and then there was a court date on October. He showed up on the October 10th date, and the one he didn't show up to was October 30th. So they didn't submit the September order that had released him. Going back to double jeopardy, the proper analysis is there's one unit of prosecution.
As a matter of law?
As a matter of law under this court's direct opinion. So the remedy for his violating, you know, court conditions is revocation of his release. And then, you know, maybe they could amend the charging document to charge a longer charging period, but there still would only be one count. So insufficient evidence on that count should result in reversal and dismissal of the whole case. And I think that's the analysis you would follow in Green, although that case involved a different failure to register provision. So that's the analysis I'm advocating. If the court goes a different route with this sort of arrest rule language, there was in fact only two arrests in this case. There was an arrest at the very beginning and then an arrest at the very end before count four. So that's really two units of prosecution, not four.
Thank you.